Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
The Athletic.
Aragon MotoGP for 2022 will be remembered for some time in Grand Prix folklore as the turnaround race for the title hunt. Championship leader Fabio Quartararo was knocked off on the first lap, and his arch rivals all finished on the podium for a huge haul of points. With Ennea Bastianini winning and Pecco Bagnaia second, that means that in just five Grand Prix, Bagnaia has turned around a 91-point deficit to just 10, with a fight back that's never been seen before in the 20-year history of MotoGP racing. Bastianini is now an outsider for the title with five races to go and 125 points still on the table. But Aleix Espargaró, who finished third at Aragon, is now just 17 points back of Quartararo's championship lead. This really is going to be a showdown over these remaining races, the first of which is this weekend in Japan. Talk about a tight schedule. All of this rather overshadowed the fact that Marc Marquez was back on a Grand Prix motorcycle after 14 weeks, but he retired on the first lap following a rather hairy opening few corners. But more on that later. You join myself, Toby Moody, with Simon Patterson and Valentin Hurunci. We're going to talk all things Aragon 2022 here. Simon, you were in the press office. I know the atmosphere in that press office. I bet the roof came off it during that first opening lap.
It was, yeah, well, it's just one of those things where suddenly everyone's shouting and screaming. Like the response in the media center is exactly the response that is watching on your sofa, except there's, you know, 200 of us. And both the first lap and the last lap actually got a pretty similar response in this race. People didn't know what to make of it. My initial thought, actually, whenever I saw the Nakagami crash, I thought initially we were watching an instant replay of the first incident with Marquez and Quartararo. It was just such a mess for that space of time between the middle of turn four and the exit of turn seven.
Val, what did you think when you saw it?
I don't know. It's a really, really surreal experience in a way. Just all like both the first lap and the last lap. For me, obviously, you know, the first lap, that kind of thing happens. The last lap I was more surprised by because that part was a lot more preventable by Ducati chiefs, which we will get to. So yeah, it is a race that the more you think about, the harder it is to really know what you made of it, I think.
For me, I cannot believe that Ducati don't have team orders right now. Bastianini is a factory Ducati rider next year, and arguably he's taking points away from Bagnaia for this challenge to win in 2022 against Quartararo. Obviously, Bastianini has got the talent. He's now won four Grand Prix just this year alone, but he will have his day on the works bike in 23 and 24. The risk for the pair of them to have gone down the road during those last laps was, for me, a little bit too great, and maybe too great for the big bosses at Ducati, who have only won one title in 20 years. The great and mighty Ducati, with all of the budget that they've had. I'm sure Claudio Domenicali, watching that race yesterday, well, what little hair he's still got is now on his sitting room floor, because as a team, you've got to do everything within your power to win. But arguably, Simon, Val, on current form, Bagnaia won't need team orders to help him win the title, but you just never know, because for me, it's just one of those odd years.
Yeah, you can't take that risk, I think. But just, you know, in a wider perspective, and just not to come off as this extremely boring and dull analytical team order advocate, last year, I watched the German Touring Car Championship final race, and I watched one of the contenders get eliminated, and then Mercedes basically wave like 15 customer cars out of the way of its another customer car to ensure that customer car wins the title. And that sucked. It was awful to watch. It was absolute crap. Completely didn't feel very sporting. Didn't feel like a rightful conclusion to the season. Team orders, they're really easy to hate. They're really easy to hate, but it's always a trade-off of how bad you look versus how much you gain. In Ducati's case, Ducati would have looked fine if it told Ené Bastianini to stay put. And the thing is, that was not going to have to be something you improvised in the race, because every single person who watched Misano, who watched any race this season, who followed practice, who followed qualifying, knew where this was going. Every single person knew that the likelihood was that Bagnaia was going to lead the first 15 laps, and then Ené Bastianini was going to come through late in the race, because that's what he does. Everybody knew that. I mean, maybe Jack Miller was going to be in the mix, running as rear gunner. Maybe somehow Fabio would have fought through or Aleix. But the likelihood was that this was going to be your situation again. And the fact that there was no interest in a contingency plan for that, or I guess the contingency plan was just go at it, surprises me a lot. And if I ran Ducati, obviously, I would not do this. I would talk to them on Sunday morning. I would go, here's how the race is likely to pan out. And Ea, if there's a buffer behind you and you're behind Pecco, you've won three races this year, you're going to be in factory red next year, just sit back, sit behind them. It's not even the 5 points. 5 points is a lot. It could be a lot, because ultimately Quartararo would probably feel a lot worse with a 5 point lead than a 10 point lead, you know, the optics, etc. But the title, I think, is probably not going to be decided by 5 points, although who the hell knows. But it's, he could have fallen under pressure. You add the extra unnecessary risk of trying to get him to buckle when he's pushing super hard, because he knows that the guy behind doesn't have his back. And that's not on Bastianini, because if you're Bastianini and you're not told to hang back, obviously you go for the win. But it's the risk. Why? I don't really get it. And I know it made for a better race, so thanks for that. But you've not won a rider's title since 2007. Don't you want this?
It doesn't surprise me at all that there was no Ducati team orders. And it's not because I think that Ducati are like altruistic or anything like that. I think it is just incredibly indicative of the entire Ducati approach to MotoGP. They don't know what they want. This is their strategy. It's like a scattergun strategy of support everyone, let everyone win, have 8 bikes on the grid, have 4 different people who can win races, have every one of their riders on the podium or pole position this season. They're just all over the place. And there needs to be a decisive, coherent strategy that's top down that says, this is the pecking order and this is how things are going to be. That isn't something that needs to be laid out halfway through a season when one of your riders is suddenly starting to come back into championship contention either. That is something that needs to be laid down before the first race with all 8 riders and all 4 team bosses in a room together being told this is how it's going to be this year. Because otherwise, what's the point? What's the point in putting all of this effort into trying to win championships whenever then your own worst enemy, quite literally, is yourself? Because that's what we're saying here.
I mean, team orders don't have to be obvious. Val, that DTM thing last year was a bit of a stinker. The Rubens Barrichello, Michael Schumacher, Austria, Ferrari thing, 20 years ago now, that was a bit of a stinker, and the crowd told them as such. But it doesn't exactly need to be a after you, Claude, at the final corner and pull over and make it hugely obvious. But when there's a 50 million euro budget being spent per year in a factory team, they're going to have to be careful, as Simon touched on, to be playing around with personal pride rather than a corporate victory. I don't think we've lit the blue touch paper.
Ultimately, I think, honestly, if I'm one of the designers of that bike, I'm incandescent. Like, as a normal viewer who has no stake in the game, it's fairer to have Bagnaia 10 points behind Fabio than 5, because Fabio did not deserve what happened to him at Aragon. He deserves to have more of a lead than he does right now. But as a Ducati, like, they're obviously not maximizing it. And I think I heard an interview with, I want to say, Paolo Ciabatti after the race, I think, where he sort of indicated, we'll see about team orders in the next few races. Either do them or don't. What is this? Come on. Like, why not now? What's changed?
What's the vibe in the press office about this, Sam?
Honestly, everyone's surprised they're not doing it.
Oh, okay.
There's not, it's not like the media center are saying, oh, well done, Ducati, and being honorable and not having team orders. And it's like you say, it doesn't have to be obvious.
Mm-hmm.
The solution for me on Sunday would have been quite simply an instruction to Enea Bastianini. We know that he's been given an instruction saying, don't do anything stupid. And he didn't do anything stupid. He pulled off a clean, well-calculated, like a real thinking man's overtake, that was. But for me, the clear instruction would have been, look, if you find yourself in P2 behind Pecco Bagnaia, you do not come within half a second of him. That would be the clear instruction. Because like you say, Val, it's whenever people are put under pressure that mistakes happen, big mistakes happen. It doesn't necessarily have to be a mistake made by Enea Bastianini to cause Pecco Bagnaia to lose 20 or 25 points.
Yeah.
Let's be frank here. We've seen Pecco Bagnaia be more than capable of making his own mistakes when he's put under pressure in the past.
Yeah.
And Ducati have to know that. They have to know that there is a little bit of risk of him folding because he's done it before.
I like to think, though, that he's put that to bed. But I know what you're saying.
I do too. But you can't take that risk whenever you've spent 15 years and probably, what are we talking, 50 million euros times 15 to try and win this championship?
A lot of money.
You can't do that.
And I mean, it's not even about his like past record of errors. It's just you put any rider under such pressure, they might buckle. That's...
Yeah.
It's a last lap fight for the win. People fall off when that happens. Le Mans, Rossi, Vinales, you know, it obviously happens. I'm really surprised that Pecco publicly has basically not said anything about it, has not showed any discontent about how this is being handled. I'd really like to know what his stance is in private, but in public, he really has not shown that it's bothered him even a little bit.
And I take my hat off to him for that.
It really is to his credit. Yeah. But I just imagine, let's go to like 2017 or something. Imagine a low grip race in whatever track, whatever town. Let's say it's a close fight between Marquez and Dovizioso. Let's say Marquez is winning, but Cal is second. It's a low, and Cal is closing in. Is Honda gonna? Can you imagine Honda not doing anything in that regard? Can you imagine?
But then the other thing, and this is the difference in situations, Honda wouldn't have had to.
Yeah,
because Crutchlow was arguably more of a team player than Bastianini is right now.
But yeah, but it's not like you have to, like, okay. You don't have to tell Jack Miller not to pass Pecco. Jack seems to know. Because the long run race pace for Pecco is just always better. So it's just going to be reversed in a few laps. But you have to tell your riders what you want of them. Otherwise, they're going to do what's the best for them. And they can all be blamed.
Just on a quick calculation, I reckon by my maths, so obviously some money has come back in by sponsorship, but Ducati have probably spent the guts of €750 million trying to win a championship since their last one. That's $1 billion trying to win a championship. And they're potentially going to throw it away because they're afraid to hurt Enea Bastianini's feelings. Come on, guys.
That's Skunk Works budget, that is.
Exactly. Yeah. That's like, yeah, build a nuclear submarine,
that's
money.
Huge.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're going to throw away that because they won't tell him to do it. Yeah.
As I said earlier, as a team, when you're in a team, and I'm in a team in another form of motorsport at the moment, you do everything you can before the flag drops to have an advantage. And even if you're an amateur racer at Mallory Park or you're an amateur racer at Eastern Creek, or Laguna Seca, but this is business. This is huge stuff. You cannot mess about. And Simon's numbers there are, you can't get your head around them. In fact, you can't get your head around them.
And again, like the weirdest and I would say most downing, if you want to say it that way, thing is, again, we could tell how this race was going to play out. This does not surprise anybody because we've seen this exact thing before.
Yeah,
which to change the topic a little bit, is to Enea Bastianini's massive credit. Incredible. It is incredible how routine it is now that, you know, just come the last five laps, he kicks all sort of butt. He is the best rider on the grid in the last laps. That's when the points are awarded. He can win the championship next year.
Yeah.
Correct. So Bastianini at the moment, with 125 points still on the table, is 48 back of the championship leader Quartararo. Does he have a bit of a vibe that he can do this?
No, not really. He says it's clear from his rhetoric that it's far-fetched, and he's right. It is far-fetched. Obviously, 125 available, 45 up for grabs, but with three riders ahead, the maths just doesn't really work unless something goes super weird.
But we saw that yesterday as well.
No, but it would have to go
you
super weird.
Three misses.
No. I mean someone else's accident with Mark Tucker.
Yeah, you're not wrong. But
arguably, it almost happened in Assen.
Yeah.
If Felicia Spagaro's bike had been a little bit more damaged,
but it would take several races of things going really, really weird, or it would take one race of things going really weird, and then NA winning all five, which is
and that's not going to happen.
Yeah,
that's not good because that advantage that he has won't be as powerful at places like Phillip Island.
Yeah.
There will be circuits coming up where it isn't as big an advantage as it is at Aragon.
And also there are circuits coming up that he just doesn't know on a MotoGP bike.
Well, that's it. There's three in a row coming up now.
Yeah.
And let's not forget, he has also crashed four times this season. He's not Mr. Consistency.
Very true. Is, with Bastianini, an element of Carlo Panat, his legendary manager, who has been around the paddock for 40 years. He ran Aprilia, he managed Caparossi. I think he's a dude, but I wouldn't want to do a deal with him. I think he's great company, but I wouldn't want to do a deal with him. Is that element of a wolfish smile, but actually, I'll have you.
Can you imagine anyone in Ducati, Gigi Deligna, Paolo Tsabate, Davide Tardozzi, coming to Pernat to give him the team order speech? He'd be laughed out of the room because that's not Pernat's way of doing things. He is an animal.
With his baggy shirt and his Rolex dripping off his wrist. Fantastic.
And a cigarette hanging out of his fingers. That would be... and I think there is definitely, there's a bit of that. I don't know if it's rubbed off in Bastianini or if Bastianini has found a manager who fits his personality quite well, because we didn't really know Bastianini before he was under Pernat's wing, so it's kind of hard to work out if it's a good combination or one influence in the other, but they're quite similar. There's that kind of roguish, good-humoured charm, but you'd count your fingers after shaking hands with them.
Yeah. Makes me think that Ducati should have waited until the last round to announce who's going to go to the factory bike next to Bagnaia. Even though right now it's clear, I think they've made the right choice. But yeah.
And can you, like, what happens if we're in a situation now where it's not unreasonable to suggest that this championship will be lost by Ducati by 4 points, the 4 or 5 points that Enea cost them yesterday, and then we go into next season and he wins the opening three races and Pagnaia's head falls off. Like, it's more Ducati bad people management.
We'll see. If ultimately Bagnaia wins by 40 points in the end, all of this will be purely academic. But right now,
if he wins by 40 points, I will eat someone's hat. He might win the championship, but points.
I don't have a hat. Hope you do.
I do. And you don't want to eat mine, Simon.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere. Like when your fantasy league meets up at your house, Everything's great until the hot plate gets too hot for the tablecloth. Now your kitchen's up in smoke. And if you don't have the right home insurance coverage, the cost to fix this is anything but a fantasy. So switch to Allstate, save money, and get protected from mayhem like this. Not available in every state. Based on coverage selected, subject to terms, conditions, and availability. Savings vary.
So Fabio Quartararo was the reigning world champion and the championship leader, came out of Aragon. Well, he didn't even do the first lap. Terrifying crash. Marc Marquez was in front of him. He had a wobble. Marc rolled off the throttle just momentarily, stopped the acceleration. Quartararo was still accelerating and went straight up the back of Marc's Repsol Honda. It was a racing incident. He's lucky he kind of got away with it with Motegi this weekend. I mean, they're back on a bike in just 5 days' time. It's mind-bending what they've got to do. But Simon, it wasn't the only crash he had. Now, this is unbelievable.
Yeah. So shortly after all the chaos that everyone saw on TV erupted, I got a text message from one of our photographers who was trackside to say Fabio has crashed on the Marshall scooter. And I thought, okay. And then we started getting a bit more information. And my initial thought was, so about once every 4 or 5 rounds, a photographer comes into the media center looking a bit worse for wear because they've been banging around on a scooter in a service road. They've hit a patch of gravel, front is washed out, and they've scraped themselves and maybe dented a camera. And my first thought was, okay, it's something like that. It won't be, you know, it won't be a big thing. Then we started getting more information. And so when we spoke to Fabio Quartararo, the way he described it was, he said they were going fast. And he made a real point of like, we were going fast. We were going really fast.
This is
like,
a MotoGP rider made talking a point. Here.
This is a MotoGP rider saying like, we were moving. Whatever happened, it seems like one of the Moto3 teams had someone out trackside spectating and they head on collisioned into this other scooter. And you know, Fabio straight up said, if I'd taken my helmet off and had been hanging it around my arm, we would be in trouble. We would have had an issue. It seems like the Marshall, we haven't got a condition update on him, but he needed medical treatment. He went to the medical center in a stretcher. It was a high speed shunt, whatever happened. And it doesn't rain, but it pours with Fabio Quartararo. This is the second time this season, only the second time this season he's DNF'd. And both times he's DNF'd, he's managed to crash twice. Because let's not forget, in Assen, he rejoined, the traction control was broken and he launched himself to the moon. Fortunately, he didn't have any, he didn't get any more injured from the scooter crash. And he goes into Motegi pretty battered and bruised, but thankfully nothing that's going to impact him too badly. He says he's got a big bruise in his hip, but in 3 days' time, he knows that the bruise will be yellow and it'll be fine. And he's got quite a bit of abrasions on his chest from essentially getting run over by a motorbike, flipping over and then sliding along the ground at 100 mile an hour and rubbing himself quite raw on his chest. Not ideal by any stretch of the imagination.
Holy smoke. Well, that something needs to change. And I've seen it in other forms of motorsport, like track days, when amateurs drive a professional driver around a circuit and you can drive at half the speed, but the professional driver be twice as terrified as the speed that he can do. It's just the capability. Something's going to change there, I hope.
Multiple riders, sensible riders afterwards were like, yeah, that's not a surprise. Like they were like, yeah, no, that was something that was a matter of time waiting to happen. And I don't think that's not something specific to the Aragon Marshals. But we regularly see guys going very fast on scooters, on rough gravel roads. You know, there's a reason that in BSB, where there's much less service roads and much more sort of picking your way around the circuits, that they use Yamaha Tenere's adventure bikes to bring back crashed riders, because they're a bit more capable and a bit less likely to do this. There will have to be, I would imagine, there will be, the first thing we'll see is less people allowed in the service roads from now on. The next thing we will see is a restriction to if you're a Moto3 team, you're only allowed on during a Moto3 race and so on. And hopefully we maybe see some sort of a standard introduced for Marshall recovery, you know, for bikes, for riding standards, for...
Particularly for Quartararo, what's the rush in getting him back? It wasn't as if there was a red flag and he could jump on the spare bike because the race hadn't happened. It red flagged on the first lap, but yeah. What's he like in his state of mind? Because the pressure's on.
Yeah.
And he's not cracking. I have to say, I've seen, you know, we've dealt with Fabio Quartararo while he's kind of falling apart mentally a little bit and going from second to eighth in the championship standings in the course of a few weeks. And that's not the guy that was there yesterday. We had someone who I think expected this to be a bad weekend. Obviously didn't expect it to be this bad, but knew it was going to be tough one way or another and came into this weekend with the mentality of just getting through it. And I think that helped yesterday afternoon because then it meant that you know, he was kind of, it would have been different if he'd had pace for the win. But he just, it wasn't going to happen yesterday. He knew that before he even arrived here. He knows that he goes from here to circuits that he has an advantage at. You know, multiple people have kind of pointed out that arguably his greatest races in MotoGP, those series of battles at the end of 2019 with Marc Marquez, a lot of them came in venues like Buriram as a rookie. So going back there now with that experience against guys who don't know those tracks anywhere near as well as him, you know, quite a few of the riders in our grid have never raced these circuits in a MotoGP bike. And we're not talking Darren Binder in that. We're not talking the 2022 rookies. We're talking like the 2020 rookies have never raced these tracks. So I think he knows that he still has an advantage. He knows that he still has a points lead. And I think there's probably a part of him that's thinking the fact that Aleix Espargaró also closed down is actually a benefit, not a bad thing. I think he'd be in a different position if he thought it was a straight fight against Bagnaia. And the fact that there's a third person in there is maybe taking some pressure off.
And distracting Bagnaia.
It's just another element to consider. And that works in his advantage at the minute while he's still in the lead.
But my guess is maybe a little bit different is that there's probably a feeling that he's playing with, I think I said it before, but he's playing with house money and that the bike's just not as good as the Ducati and there's only so much you can do. And when something like what happened on Sunday happens, all you can do is just laugh and dust yourself off and go again. Nothing he could have done differently. He was running close behind Mark. It's maybe a little bit too close, but it's something you have to do when you're on a Yamaha. Otherwise, you're going to get stuck and your race is going to be effectively done. He had a good pace, had really good pace on Saturday, as he always does. But at Aragon, I guess it's a little bit more meaningful because you don't really expect... You expect Fabio to be stronger over one lap than over race pace at Aragon. And he had really, really good pace, but it doesn't really matter when there's five Ducatis ahead because you can't pass him. He took some encouragement in that, but I think it's just getting this out of the way and seeing, as you said, seeing what he can do on those tracks that will be fresher for a lot more people and that he has proven he can go super well at. And obviously not just the Motegi-Buriram duo where he fought Mark, but also Phillip Island should be really good, for instance. But yeah, there's only... Like, if he rocks up to those tracks and it's, again, 15 Ducatis ahead of him in qualifying, it doesn't really matter what happened at Aragon. No chance. But if, you know, if the Yamaha is anywhere near as good there as it was back in 2019 or whatever, then Aragon might not matter either way, but just for a different reason, because he'll be able to get his advantage back.
Well, Quartararo obviously went up the back of Marc Marquez on that opening lap. Marc was likewise lucky, because he had a bit of the bodywork from Quartararo jammed under his seat. It was all into the swing arm. It was a mess. It was an unfortunate racing accident, but arguably the second accident that happened with Mark and Taka Nakagami was more scary from my point of view, because you know, some of the big horrible accidents that we've seen in MotoGP over the last 15 years have been people falling off, surviving the falling off, but then something terrible happening. So it was a close one. What did Mark have to say afterwards, Simon? Val, take it away.
So essentially, Mark, I admitted that the first one was a mistake, that the incident with Quartararo was his own mistake. I think perhaps there was an element of race rustiness there because it was a bit of a rookie error. Cold tire, dirty part of the track, too much gas, had to back it off. It's that's not a Marc Marquez mistake. There are Marc Marquez...
Isn't it?
I wouldn't say so. There are mistakes we see him make.
I think since comeback, we've seen a fair few times, I think, Mark go absolutely gung-ho, hell for leather on the opening couple of laps.
True.
Because he probably, there's a knowledge that this is the only time in the race that he can really make an impact. Because of his fitness, the rest of the race will be going back. I think that was actually quite expected. And it's part and parcel with, he was excellent through turn one. Fantastic. Just absolutely majestic.
Yeah, he was.
From P13, I think, to P6, around the outside, in the toe of Brad Binder, who
brilliant.
I'd quite like to talk about later.
I was about to say the second best start of the race.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, no, I think it was quite expected in a sense. I wouldn't say it's a non-Mark mistake. I would say it's this version of Mark that isn't really fighting for points right now. So he just goes when he can.
Yeah, that's fair. And then the second one was yeah, a consequence. There's an onboard shot from someone's camera, forward-facing camera, of basically a giant chunk of Yamaha fairing stuck in the back of his bike.
Yeah.
Whole shot device came down. That fairing piece got pushed onto the back tire. And to be perfectly honest, he's lucky. Taka Nakagami is exceptionally lucky, and it's testament to the reflexes of MotoGP riders that no one hit him as they all tried to duck and dodge around him. But it's also Marquez is lucky that he even got back to the pits without that tire going pop. If you know, if there was something sort of wedged into it like that, it could have been so much worse.
And when Bagnaia came around on lap two, he said that all the muck and bullets and carbon fiber was all over the track. And of course, he was the first on the scene arriving there at Flat Chat. And he was like, couldn't you have red flagged it? I thought they were going to red flag it for a moment.
There was a few people said
but,
that.
In the end, they didn't.
Now, ultimately, debris feels to me like a pretty good reason. Even if you think you can get the riders and bikes out of the way, there's a load of crap being shed onto the track by Marquez's Honda. Nah, what can you do?
But you know, in the race previously, Alonso Lopez crashed, dumped his bike almost on the racing line on the edge of the circuit. Then there was another crash in the same corner that the Marshals ran to clear first. The Moto2 pack came through on the next lap, and Alonso and his bike were still standing at the side of the track, like a meter from the racing line, and there was no red flag. So it just, you cannot assume there will ever be a red flag in MotoGP at the minute, unfortunately.
It's been misplaced somewhere, and they're probably looking for it every weekend, but it's just...
You just can't find it, eh?
Like, it's somewhere in the big freight boxes, but it's like really low down, and you just never get to it.
We'll get back to the pod in a moment, but first, a word about our partner, Grammarly. No matter what kind of work you do, how you communicate is key. All those emails, reports, and presentations are equally important to the collaboration needed to get things done. And Grammarly can help. Grammarly is your AI writing partner to help you communicate more effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact at work. I know from experience that Grammarly can help you save time on any writing task and ensure you feel confident about what you've produced. In fact, 96% of Grammarly's users report that Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing, and their tone suggestions can help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
We'll be right back. As we mentioned a moment ago, the second best start was from KTM's Brad Binder. He had his second best finish of the season after his second place that he had at the opening round in Qatar. He came home in fourth, come the flag. They do go well at Aragon, though.
Yeah, they do. But also Brad Binder goes well this season. He's really good. Aleix, after the race, after beating Brad, called him the one of the top three riders in MotoGP. I'd really like to know who the other two are in that top three. Like, is it?
I would imagine Aleix and Fabio.
Yeah. What about? But Aleix also said that Pecco is doing better than both of them right now. So Pecco.
Yeah, but I think that he probably attributes quite a bit of that to the red bike that Pecco's on.
Yeah. We could discuss the top three for quite a bit.
We know that one of Aleix's top three is definitely Aleix.
Nothing like modesty.
Yeah. In any case, I can tell you what, I think I can pretty much guarantee you, depending on what happens in the final few races. So if the season ends as it's been going, we do the top 10, Brad's going to be top five in mine, fairly certainly. He's been having a really good season. He's just gotten a lot better while the RC16 has gotten competitively worse. He's basically broken the resistance of Miguel Oliveira. The last season, 2021, there were plenty of weekends where, even though on the whole you'd say Brad had an advantage, but there were plenty of weekends where Miguel could really respond and really shine. And Miguel could also make the most of the RC16 when it was at its strongest. That's not really happening this year. This year, the one outlier was the Miguel win, in which Binder's right-hand device got stuck, I believe. So it's not really a fair comparison. And the rest of it, for the most part, Brad's had a little bit something extra in qualifying and has always been there to pretty much maximize some days. He's been really good. He was hurt this weekend. He got hurt in Saturday morning practice, his ankle. He went to the medical center a bunch, I believe. He was on painkillers on Saturday. Then I'm not sure on Sunday if he used them much, because I think his body didn't respond too well to them. And it didn't seem to matter too much, because he nearly hauled that bike onto the podium. Ran out of tire late on, so Aleix could bounce. But it's a really good showing. And I remember seeing that Brad Binder was extended through 2024 by KTM and thinking, why'd you do that? And that was like a year ago, was it? A little bit more than a year ago, I think, maybe.
A little bit more, yeah.
Didn't make a lot of sense to me, because it's just, you're just taking one seat out of the question right away for, you know, and you're going to have some interested other parties. So it's like just locking yourself out of options. Right now, it looks really good. But
he's KTM royalty, Val. He's KTM royalty because he won their first race and they will stick with him. And at the time, he was the best option. But don't underestimate that KTM royalty, because he won that first race in Brno.
At the time, you didn't have to do anything.
Yeah.
He was the best option, but you did not have to do anything.
No, they could have given him a 2-year deal and he would have been still happy.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Yeah. But they were right, because I think he's gone cheaper than he would have gone now. And I honestly, they could have maybe even lost him somehow. Probably not, because again, it's just a KTM lifer probably. But no, you don't think so?
Repsol Honda. I think Repsol Honda would have come hard.
And you can hear it in what he says, that he's not very content with where the RC16 is. I think he's entered that point in his MotoGP career where the realization came that, you know, I might be better than this already. Maybe I should be fighting out there for wins and podiums every weekend. And he would have a point in saying that.
I threw it to him yesterday afternoon what Aleix had said, which was essentially that Brad Binder is one of the top three riders in MotoGP being let down by a bad bike. And he was like, well, you know, obviously it's really nice for Aleix to say that. And then went on to detail all the ways in which his bike is worse than everyone else's, which is quite like, oh yeah, he's not beating around the bush here. He's very much in favor of that comparison. Yeah, the way that I think there's a little bit of motivational issues maybe at the other KTMs at the minute. I don't know if Miguel Oliveira is, you know, really fighting every weekend the way he would have been when he was still trying to get a contract out of them. But
I think the gap's the same as it was when he was trying
to get
a contract.
Well, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
The tech threes.
Are right. Yeah. Well, I don't think with Remy. I think Remy has a point to prove before he leaves here. I think the fact that Fernandez is staying next year means that he maybe doesn't have the same point to prove, but I think Gardner is still trying to prove something. But, I think what eventually cost Binder any chance of a podium on Sunday was the crash, was the fact that he, Miller, who had the golden seat to watch the battle between Espargaro and Binder, said he could see him fading with three laps to go, and he assumed that was the pain level rising. I overheard Binder talking to Dr. Chartra on Saturday afternoon and was saying, like, the injection you gave me was amazing. I felt nothing at all in my ankle. But then he woke up on Sunday morning and described the basically a hangover from the painkillers. So I think he went a different route for Sunday's race, and he just started to feel it a little bit at the end.
Nearly on track, but in the pit lane was the most bizarre of incidents that happened on Saturday afternoon at the end of Moto3 qualifying. The Max Biaggi sterile Garda mechanics made their way up pit lane to get in the way of one of the Red Bull KTM bikes and almost flick the switch, almost kill the switch. Anybody who's a petrol head, MotoGP head, will have seen it on social media. And no matter how many times, Simon, you look at it, you still can't believe it, can you?
So they did actually achieve their aims. They didn't go for the kills. They were going for the kill switch, I think, but they ended up catching the front brake, which was enough to stall the bike. So it did actually achieve the purpose, because they had to roll the bike back into the garage and put it back onto the starter motor.
And he missed his qualifying slot.
And he missed his qualifying lap because, yeah. I went and spoke to Max Biaggi afterwards, and I've seen Max Biaggi. We've all seen Max Biaggi angry, and it's very Italian, and there's lots of arm waving and shouting and screaming and, you know, very stereotypical. When I went to see him on Saturday afternoon, he was white with quiet rage. It was a completely different Max Biaggi anger. He was furious about what they'd done. I went and spoke to Hervé Poncherolle. Hervé was actually much more magnanimous. He said that he didn't want a huge penalty handed down, but he wanted the whole world to see what had happened so that it never happens again, which I think he has probably achieved. But I've never seen anything like it. It looks terrible. Someone sent me a link earlier to a CNN article about it. It's gone fully mainstream. And to make matters even worse, from what I understand, there was then fisticuffs in the paddock afterwards between the Fernandez family and the Max Racing team. And someone may have, from what I heard, ended up in a hospital in an A&E because they got smacked in their face. And just, it's just terrible, terrible optics for the sport. It's almost comparable with the Fanati incident in terms of the optics.
I mean, coverage in CNN, not entirely a good thing. I know, shame somebody's qualifying got ruined, and somebody got really sad, and somebody seemingly got punched in the face. I really love the championship implications of it, given where Adrian Fernandez and Max's rider Ayumu Sasaki are in the championship. It's the same as Pecco Bagnaia's crew running down pit lane and kicking Fabio Di Gianantonio's bike. Like, okay,
it's actually a fair comparison, considering that same family, both Fernandez, yeah. And they're also KTM, yeah, family.
It's just so stupid. It's like, sometimes you just gotta step back and be like, oh, this is the dumbest thing.
And to think that they won't be seen, to think that they would get away with it. I mean, it's another thing to sneak into a garage at midnight and disconnect the brake line like some comedy film.
Yeah.
Oh, damn. Yeah.
It just reminds us that real life is always stupider than scripts. It's never like this huge plan. It's just two people being like, you know, it would be funny. Let's go mess with this bike in front of everybody. Yeah, sounds like a good idea. Let's do it.
My first thought was like, oh, they've not noticed that someone in the Tech 3 garage had their phone out to record it. And then Dorna released a video. There was a MotoGP cameraman on the other side of them. Like, come on, guys. Like, oh, God. It's just, it's, yeah. Genuinely, I gave them the benefit of the doubt for as long as I could on social media afterwards. And it's because I didn't think anyone was so stupid to have done that with two cameras pointing at them and rolling. I like, that's... Come on.
Yeah. And a lot of social media chatter, and we have to be careful with that, Val Simon,
yeah,
was, oh, well, the mechanics, they didn't just go and do their own thing. It would have come from above, and the team management would have known, and the vibe in the garage, they would have known to beetle off down pit lane. It's like, No. They obviously convinced themselves after one too many Cervezas the night before that they could get away with it. I mean, and by the way, they just to reiterate to people who don't necessarily know, they've had a €2,000 fine.
The mechanics, not the team.
To the mechanics, yeah. And they've got a 2-race ban, but it won't be at this weekend at Motegi, nor in Thailand, because it's too late to replace somebody.
It took 10 weeks to get visas for everyone, yeah, for Japan.
So they will still be in the Japan pit lane. I mean... I tweeted, I said, I would send them home and I would cancel their hotel rooms before they got there.
I love the idea of this being like this huge conspiracy. Max Biaggi sitting in his chair, stroking his white cat like the Bond villain and going, okay, here's what you do. In broad daylight, you go and you mess with Adrian Fernandez's bike. Specifically, yes. Adrian Fernandez. Target him. Yeah. He's our big threat.
We're going after Adrian Fernandez here.
Love it.
Although, to be fair to Fernandez, he came out of it smelling of roses because he finished in fifth as his best ever Moto3 result really by a long way in the race on Sunday. But it's not just the two Cervezas and a dumb idea theory, Toby. The Fernandez brothers, perhaps unsurprisingly, have a reputation as being difficult to work with.
I couldn't possibly comment.
Other teams who I rate very highly have not enjoyed their time working with them. And Adrian Fernandez was in Max Racing last year on the same side of the garage as those two mechanics. So there's no conspiracy. There's no, you know, the team manager there, Peter Ottle, is one of the sanest, calmest people in the paddock. There is no way on earth that... that he orchestrated that. And I don't think Max Biaggi is a good enough actor to have the amount of anger that he had whenever I spoke to him, or the amount of sheer embarrassment he had in the Aprilia hospitality suite later that night, whenever everyone at Aprilia was coming to take the piss out of him for it, to have orchestrated that. Yeah, that was two idiots doing an idiotic thing.
In front of two cameras. Board. Now let's get that straight.
Yeah, well, exactly. Do you not think that while Max was stroking his cat, he would have said, and remember, no cameras.
And remember, get it on camera so that everybody thinks this was your idea. I love this. This is the one time I'm actually really tempted to dispose of Hanlon's razor, which says don't attribute to malice, which can be adequately explained by stupidity, and actually just push the whole, this is a wide-ranging conspiracy against Adrian Fernandez. To stop him from winning the Moto3 title. I'm sorry, Adrian Fernandez. This is very mean on my part.
Okay, right. Simon's got to go because he's in Barcelona Airport and he needs to get some breakfast because he's got a busy week because he's got to get himself to Motegi. Just take us through your flight plan.
Yeah, so everyone, you guys will have seen me just like randomly waving now and then through the podcast, and it's because half the MotoGP paddock are in the lounge and wandering past. Jorge Martin has just wandered past. Frankie Carchetti has just wandered past. And William Favreau, Director of Communications at Yamaha, is just staring at me, wondering what I'm doing in a meeting room with a microphone at this minute. We go Barcelona, Helsinki, 2.5 hours in Helsinki, hopefully into Motegi, into Narita and Tokyo, assuming we don't get caught up in the super typhoon that's currently hitting Japan. With estimated 500 milliliters of rain in a day and 250 kilometer an hour winds. So
250, that's 150 miles an hour.
250. Blimey. An unprecedented meteorological event, according to Reuters News this
that
morning.
That might just ruffle your hairstyle.
I'm less concerned about my hairstyle and more concerned about MotoGP's freight arriving in time for first practice on Friday afternoon. Remember, not Friday morning, because the schedule is already so tight. But if boxers have trouble landing in Japan, there is a very faint possibility that we have a very big problem this weekend. I'm not sure who would benefit the most from potentially losing a round off this year's calendar at this point.
Lose the round? Oh, I didn't have that in the plan.
Oh, yeah.
I just thought, well, we'll have a Saturday afternoon and go.
It depends when things arrive. But you know, I think MotoGP freight is not going to be a priority in Japan this week, given what they're expected to be facing.
And rightly so.
Yeah. In terms of civil planning, we're not there. Yeah. So let's just see what happens. Like I say, right now it does seem quite faint because the storm is due to dissipate by sort of Wednesday afternoon, Thursday morning. But depends how much damage it does on the way to us, unfortunately.
Okay, well, safe trip. Don't forget, for you, the listeners, to send in your voice messages to podcasts@the-race.com, and then we can line them all up and we can have a conversation starter. Keep in touch with the-race.com for all of your Formula One, MotoGP news. Check out our YouTube channel as well. 14 down... 15 down, sorry. 5 to go. 15 down, 5 to go. We've got Motegi this weekend, Thailand, Phillip Island, Sepang, and Valencia. Quartararo leads the championship by 10 points ahead of Pecco Bagnaia, 17 ahead of Aleix Espargaró. It certainly looks like it's going to be a showdown come Valencia.
The Athletic.